mankind's infinite dignity. The Vatican releases a much-anticipated declaration addressing controversial topics like gender ideology, surrogacy, and euthanasia. But that was just a small portion of its overall message. Our expert panel discusses key takeaways.
And now the states have it, and the states are putting out what they want. It's the will of the people.
The president, who takes credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, sends mixed messages about the pro-life way forward. We talked to one of our nation's leading pro-life champions, Marjorie Dannenfelter, about abortion politics in America.
Christian people that would come out to us on the streets and try and talk to us about this Jesus. But I hated them.
A formerly homeless woman shares her long and painful faith journey to God and the work she now does for those living on the streets. And we talk to the photographer who took exclusive pictures of Saint Padre Pio as those photos are released to the public decades later. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
When the church defends life from conception, it is not because of sexist fanaticism or backward mentality.
The Vatican releases a much-anticipated document on the dignity of the human person, addressing such controversial issues as gender ideology, surrogacy, abortion, and euthanasia. It also took on the broad themes of poverty, war, and human trafficking. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro, sitting in this week for Monse Alvarado. Dignitas Infinita was 5 years in the making. Having gone through multiple revisions, the Vatican document has been largely well-received since its release. Many observers say the declaration articulates a clear moral vision based on fundamental Catholic Church teaching. On this year's Solemnity of the Annunciation, the very day the Church celebrated Christ's conception, the Vatican released a new document this week upholding the dignity of all human life.
Questo documento è una dichiarazione.
The 20-page declaration called Dignitas Infinita, or Infinite Dignity, has been in the works for 5 years. After recent revisions, it was approved by Pope Francis in late March and published Monday. Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, head of the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, oversaw the writing of the document, which reiterates the Church's teaching that everyone has a God-given, inalienable dignity. It addresses grave violations to that inherent human dignity, which can range from war to sexual abuse to assisted suicide. But Dignitas Infinita marks the first time the Church's universal teaching authority has weighed in on the topic of gender theory and sex change procedures with such great focus, drawing the heaviest amount of media attention. On the topic of gender theory, Dignitas Infinita states, "All attempts to obscure reference to the ineliminable sexual difference between man and woman are to be rejected." Cardinal Fernandez addressed that during a Vatican press briefing this week.
Because we believe that these ideologies, instead of helping to recognize dignity, impoverish a humanistic vision where man and woman are the most beautiful combination in the greatest difference that humanity contains. This is unparalleled.
On sex change surgery, Dignitas Infinita states, "We are called to protect our humanity, and this means, in the first place, accepting it and respecting it as it was created. It follows that any sex change intervention, as a rule, risks threatening the unique dignity the person has received from the moment of conception." The new DDF Vatican document hit on other hot-button issues as well, saying the practice of surrogacy violates the dignity of the child, and surrogacy also violates the dignity of the woman.
Let us try to be consistent with the dignity of the human being, regardless of any circumstance, whether or not it came out of the womb. The dignity is the same.
And on the topic of abortion, the Vatican does not mince words in Dignitas Infinita, citing St. John Paul II, and that procured abortion is the deliberate and direct killing by whatever means it is carried out, of a human being in the initial phase of his or her existence, extending from conception to birth. Dignitas Infinita is a wide-ranging document that Fernandez says reflects Pope Francis's pastoral priorities.
To help us better understand the significance of this new Vatican document, we're joined by two gentlemen who have been taking a close look at Dignitas Infinita this week. Dr. John Grabowski is a professor of moral theology and ethics at the Catholic University of America. His expertise includes sexual ethics and gender issues. He's the author of several books, including Unraveling Gender, The Battle Over Sexual Difference. And Jonathan Liedl is senior editor for our EWTN news partner, the National Catholic Register. Thank you both for being here. John, I want to come to you first. The dicastery for the doctrine of the faith is being clear here on gender theory and sex change procedures. How significant were the comments on gender, especially the statement against obscuring the sexual difference between man and woman?
Catherine, great to be with you. I think the document is wonderfully clear on this topic, and it draws a very clear line. I wish it hadn't used the language of sex change, which is actually kind of a misnomer, because gender transitioning procedures, whether chemical or surgical, don't actually change a person's sex, even on the biological level. They do nothing to genetic sex. A person will have to stay on cross-sex hormones for their entire life because their body is actively resisting the chemical bombardment. But other than that little bit of unfortunate language, it is wonderful that the document is very clear that these procedures attack the goodness of the body, sexual difference, and the gift of sexuality. Mm. There are some very strong echoes of the theology of the body in this section.
A lot of sightings of St. John Paul II. Jonathan, at the Monday Vatican press conference for Dignitas Infinita, Cardinal Fernandez began with a lengthy defense of the controversial document Fiducia Supplicans, which allows for the non-liturgical blessing of same-sex couples. Is it possible, as some critics have suggested, that the timing of Dignitas Infinita's release was to appease the critics of Fiducia Supplicans? What's the dynamic between these two documents? Well,
that's a great question, Catherine. Some people have suggested that. And in fact, the first time we had confirmation that Dignitas Infinita was coming out was when Cardinal Fernandez was engaged in a bit of damage control in the weeks following the publication of Fiducia Supplicans, which was certainly a controversial document. So some people have speculated, is this document only coming out right now to quell controversy? Cardinal Fernandez said back then that even though conservative-minded Catholics might have been upset about Fiducia Supplicans, the forthcoming document on dignity would be more to their speed. Mm. But if we actually look at the timeline of this document, which is included in the introduction of the text, we know that Cardinal Fernandez met with Pope Francis to present what was then a final draft of this document in November of 2023. Mm. Now, Pope Francis did ask him to broaden the scope and include a focus on issues like poverty and war. But we also can look back to 2019, when really this document in the then Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith mm-hmm. began to be worked on. So mm-hmm. it's certainly been a long time coming, and I think many people are grateful to have it here now.
Really good point. John, the English translation of this Vatican document is infinite dignity, which itself is causing some pushback. What do you think is meant by that, and do humans have infinite dignity if we are finite beings?
Yeah, I think it's another bit of unfortunate word choice. Something like inestimable dignity or inalienable dignity would have been better and more precise, because as you indicate, only God is infinite. So only God has infinite attributes, qualities. So mm-hmm. we're speaking kind of more poetically than precisely, which is not necessarily what we look for from the DDF. Here, but the point is that we have a dignity that isn't given by the state or isn't mm-hmm. earned because we have a certain kind of rationality or we can function at a certain level, which is what the document describes as personal dignity. Instead, mm-hmm. our dignity is ontological. It's rooted in our human nature, in the fact that we're made in the image and likeness of God, in the fact that we are called to mm-hmm. eternal life with God through the incarnation, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So God has bestowed this great ontologically rooted dignity on each and every human person. Mm.
But a distinction between moral dignity, for example.
Sure, we can act, as the document says, we have freedom, and we can act in ways that are contrary to our dignity. That's mm-hmm. that's moral dignity. So we can act in ways that fundamentally contradict and contravene that dignity, but we cannot erase the mm-hmm. dignity that has been given to us by God. Mm.
Jonathan, the U.S. Bishops Conference was reportedly blocked from publishing its own document on gender ideology back in 2018 because the Vatican said it was working on its own text. Well, now we have that text. What do you expect to see from the U.S. bishops on gender theory moving forward?
Well, Catherine, USCCB spokeswoman Chaco Noguchi has already said that the U.S. bishops welcome this document and they'll be reflecting upon it and studying it and probably preparing to implement aspects of it. Of course, even though the USCCB has not issued a unified teaching or pastoral document on gender theory, individual bishops have certainly been providing their own guidance in their diocese. We think of places like the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, Archdiocese of Omaha, or the Diocese of Arlington. And the USCCB has also weighed in with a particular doctrinal note on the moral limitations of surgeries that might transform the human body. Mm-hmm. But exactly right, now that the Vatican has issued this long-awaited guidance, I think we can really expect the USCCB to pick up what the Vatican has given them and run with it. Mm-hmm. I think people have been asking across the church for a long time for more concrete guidance on not only the teaching dimensions related to gender theory, but also practically, how do we address it? Abigail Favalli, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame, she said that the document's doctrinal clarification on gender theory is like a guardrail that we can now hang on to as we engage in pastoral areas. We think about not just surgery and hormonal interventions, but also how do we use language? Mm-hmm. How does dress, how we present ourselves, relate to our sexual mm-hmm. identity and dignity? And of course, that vexing question of bathroom facilities and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So I really think that now with the Vatican weighing in, that the U.S. bishops as a whole and also Catholic apostolates around mm-hmm. the country and the world really have inspiration and encouragement to begin to apply mm-hmm. this doctrinal clarity on a pastoral level.
John, put this into a theological lens for us. What is the weight of this document, and how does it compare to other documents from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith?
Well, that's a good question. So a document of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, especially an instruction such as this one, it's a magisterial act. It's promulgated with the Pope's permission and authority. So this is a teaching of the Church's ordinary and universal magisterium, albeit it's not something that comes directly from the Pope. It's not an encyclical letter or an apostolic letter or exhortation. So it doesn't have that same solemnity, but clearly it is intended to be authoritative teaching for the universal Church. And if I can just interject, I actually, as an advisor to the USCCB, mm-hmm. saw a draft of the Vade Mecum on gender that the U.S. bishops were working on, and it was hopefully still is a wonderful document, mm-hmm. and actually I think very complementary to this one, and went into a lot of kind of the practical pastoral applications in terms of liturgical celebration, parish life, and other questions related to this set of issues. So I'm hopeful that a version of that document might now see the light of day.
That's great insight. Obviously, we'll continue to track that. Jonathan, we just have 1 minute left, but how do you think this document reflects Pope Francis's pastoral priorities?
Well, Catherine, I think Pope Francis has been saying for a long time that everything is connected. It was a theme of Laudato Si, and we really see this coming out in this document as well. Human dignity is really this thread that ties together this beautiful moral vision that applies to all kinds of issues across the church and society. And so I think this is really underscoring, Pope Francis's desire for us not simply to receive the gospel in our heart, but to allow it to bear fruit and to allow it to shape the way that we engage, not only in politics, but also our interactions with our neighbors and those we encounter. So I think that comes through in this document as well.
Well, I'm so grateful for both of your insights and expertise on this, Dr. John Grabowski, Jonathan Liedl. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Catherine.
Thank you.
Pope Francis will be embarking on the longest trip of his pontificate this coming September. Accepting invitations from heads of state and church authorities, the Vatican announced on Friday the Holy Father will visit three nations in Asia and one in Oceania. From September 3rd through 6th, he will travel first to Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim-majority country. Catholics number about 8 million there, or about 3% of the population. Pope Francis will then fly east to Papua New Guinea, followed by Timor-Leste, where Catholics account for 96% of the population. And finally, Singapore. The full program of the Holy Father's journey is not yet released. Coming up next, abortion, elections, and a game-changing court decision in Arizona. We go in-depth on abortion politics when we return.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land.
Mr. President, did Arizona go too far?
Did Arizona go too far?
Yeah, they did, and that'll be straightened out.
Whiplash. Former President Donald Trump sends conflicting signals about his stance on abortion. Pro-life leader Marjorie Dannenfelter defends the pro-life position and finds herself a target on his social media. Her take when she joins us in studio next.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint. The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. At the end of the day, it's all about will of the people. That's where we are right now, and that's what we want, the will of the people.
In a highly anticipated announcement made on his Truth Social account this week, former President Donald Trump says he does not support a federal abortion limit and that the abortion issue should be left to the states. As the nation heads into an intense and divisive election season, abortion remains a top issue for voters on both the state and national level. And Republicans are struggling to find a clear position on the matter. Highlighting the stark divide of opinion across America, reaction to a major decision earlier this week from the Arizona Supreme Court, which upheld an Arizona law from 1864 that protects life throughout pregnancy. That ruling will likely help shape the election in this key battleground state later this year.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
The Arizona legislature erupted into shouting on Wednesday after Republican lawmakers quickly shut down discussion over the abortion law. The law protects the unborn in all cases, except, the law says, when it's necessary to save the life of the mother. The high court's judges, all Republicans, said the 160-year-old law is now enforceable, though the ruling is on hold for 14 days and sent back to a lower court for additional arguments. Originally passed before Arizona became a state and before women had the right to vote, the pro-life law remained dormant for decades while Roe v. Wade was in effect, but received new life after the Dobbs decision in 2022. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs decried the ruling.
Let me be clear. Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near-total Civil War-era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state. As governor, I promised I would do everything in my power to protect our reproductive freedoms.
The decision will give Arizona the strongest abortion law out of the six top swing states in the November election. The Arizona ruling came just one day after former President Trump announced his stance on abortion. For months, voters on both sides of the issue wondered whether the Republican presidential hopeful would work to protect life on the national level if he were to be reelected for a second term. But in his new statement, Trump makes it clear he has no interest in pursuing a federal limit and even calls abortion a personal issue. In his announcement, Trump did not specify when he thinks abortion should be limited. Instead, he emphasized the issue should be left up to the states and said he supports exceptions in the case of rape, incest, or life of the mother. And he once again touted that he appointed the conservative justices who ultimately overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022.
Trump also voiced his support for the availability of in vitro fertilization, which the Catholic Church teaches is morally unacceptable. Trump's video received mixed reactions from pro-life leaders. Some advocates offered support for the former president's plan. Others believe it to be a grave misstep for pro-life policy.
States, mobs, don't get to decide, should not get to decide who lives or dies.
Fierce reaction from Lila Rhodes, founder and president of Live Action, to Donald Trump's newly stated stance on abortion. On her podcast, the pro-life leader asked fellow advocates to take an honest look at what's at stake for the unborn.
Yes, I will fully acknowledge President Biden is worse on abortion than President Trump. That is not an argument. But President Trump here is indicating he would not pass any pro-life law at the federal level when he takes power. Let the states figure it out. And the reality is he could pass a federal law if he had both houses of Congress, which we might get. It's possible. We've had it before.
Former Vice President Mike Pence also spoke out against his old boss on X, calling Trump's retreat on the right to life a slap in the face to the millions of pro-life Americans who voted for him in 2016 and 2020.
Unborn children have never had a stronger defender in the White House.
In 2020, Donald Trump was met with cheers from thousands of pro-life advocates at the annual March for Life, where he became the first president to attend the largest pro-life gathering in the country.
We know that every human soul is divine and every human life, born and unborn, is made in the holy image of Almighty God.
While Trump takes credit for appointing three Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade and previously promised to sign a late-term abortion ban into law if given the opportunity, he's now making clear if reelected, he would not lead the push for a federal abortion ban in the Oval Office. He doubled down again Wednesday in Atlanta, telling a reporter no when asked if he'd sign a federal ban.
Would you sign a national abortion ban in Congress?
And though Trump says he views abortion as a states' rights issue, he also this week pushed back on the Arizona Supreme Court ruling that upholds a state law protecting life throughout pregnancy.
Mr. President, did Arizona go too far?
Did Arizona go too far?
Yeah, they did, and that'll be straightened out. And as you know, it's all about states' rights. That'll be straightened out.
The former president has always been a divisive figure in the pro-life movement, but his new comments bring to the surface the pro-life debate as to the federal role in protecting unborn life. His states' rights stance elicited a range of responses from pro-life advocates.
Unless we are going to recognize and end abortion from the moment of conception, a federal ban would be a disaster otherwise.
Some pro-life leaders came out in support of Trump's emphasis on state legislation, saying a 15-week limit would not save the majority of children who are killed by abortion. According to the latest data from the CDC, more than 93% of abortions in 2021 were performed at or before 13 weeks gestation. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life of America, believes Trump made the right call. He, quote, listened to pro-lifers and isn't going to allow a divisive late-term limit that some GOP insiders have been pushing. She also emphasized that we clearly have some work to do to educate the Trump administration to come on the many ways that abortion has been made federal. Sean Carney, president of 40 Days for Life, told EWTN News Nightly that Trump's strategy makes sense for the current landscape of abortion in the United States.
I think what he did actually makes sense. He took credit for overturning Roe v. Wade. He highlighted how so many abortion advocates want infanticide and late-term abortion. I don't like some of the wording he did. He said abortion rights, which is absurd. But overall, this is way better than a 15-week ban.
Prominent pro-life leader Marjorie Dannenfelser, who served as head of Trump's pro-life coalition in his previous campaigns, notably was quick to speak out following Trump's announcement, writing, quote, "We are deeply disappointed in President Trump's position. The Dobbs decision clearly allows both states and Congress to act. Saying the issue is back to the states cedes the national debate to the Democrats, who are working relentlessly to enact legislation mandating abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. If successful, they will wipe out states' rights." And joining us now in studio is Marjorie Dannenfelser, herself president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. Marjorie, thanks for being here. What
a week.
Quite a week.
So let's dive right in. President Trump has been all over the map on this issue of a federal abortion limit. We have a timeline for our viewers to look at where they can see his shifting stance. Mm-hmm. His announcement this week, did he tank his pro-life credibility?
Well, here's what I think is on the table. There is a very important, urgent political question that has to be answered. Who will we vote for president? Mm-hmm. But the question you're getting to, and that a lot of pro-life leaders just spoke to, was where is the appropriate battleground for this most important human rights battle of our time? Right. Only in the states, or is it a matter for our nation? Mm-hmm. If this movement cedes the territory to the states only and says that your geography is predictive of whether you live or die in our country, then this movement is headed for the ash heap of history, in my opinion.
And we'll delve into that strategy behind, that thinking behind a 15-week abortion limit. Mm-hmm. Your statement in response to Trump, that we read that in part, received a lot of attention, including from President Trump himself, who had some sharp words on his Truth Social account. Marjorie, I want to give you the opportunity to respond. What do you want to say to his claim that you should be helping Republicans win elections rather than making it impossible?
Well, we've always believed, and in my partnership with the president in the past administration and the vice president in the last administration, we've always believed that what you do is the smartest political thing that you can do in the moment. You make that strong increment. Be as bold and ambitious as you can be, given the fact that our nation includes California and Alabama. Mm. So what would that consensus be? It would be a smart political move. And that is the correct moral position to take as well. Mm. You can't separate those things. You can't say that that all of a sudden you abandon the desire to get to consensus when finally we have the ability to pass something. Look, 15 weeks, maybe that's 2 weeks when you look at across the country, considering all those states. Right. But I would say this, that the most important question on the table is whether the federal government has anything to say. Is there anything rooted in our Constitution that says that points to the value and dignity of every human life, or does it not? Mm. I think that I would just say this, that and my past support of this president, mm-hmm. who made this moment possible, mm-hmm. the best possible advice, which I gave him over many, many months, including mm-hmm. up until just this week, right. was that the 15-week limit was a place to begin. It could be stronger, perhaps, but somewhere. And that is the contrast with the other side that we need.
Well, and as of late March, he seemed to be voicing support for the 15-week limit. Speaking of smart political moves, if you will, I mean, there are people who see Trump's move as politically savvy, given that voters in seven states now with these ballot initiatives have been siding with abortion advocates. So what do you say to people who see this as actually a politically savvy move? And is the pro-life issue, is that a losing issue now?
Well, I think it's where you position yourself as to whether you're in a losing posture or not. I think there's no question about this, just to be clear. And Lila said it too. The contrast between letting states speak and letting states land where the consensus is, mm-hmm. Contrasted with no limit on abortion and the idea that this current administration, if they have a Senate and a House, would wipe out every single pro-life protection. They will eliminate the filibuster. They will do that. So the contrast means, yes, of course, we have to elect this president, and we will need to at least get the House or the Senate and the presidency.
So to clarify, you are still supporting President Trump in this campaign?
Yes. But to your mm-hmm. question, mm-hmm. which is this a losing issue? It does not have to be that. And I would encourage all people who believe in this issue, everyone who's been doing this for all these years, and new people coming into the movement, don't lose your confidence in the fact that this is way deeper than the political stance that we're taking right now, and that it is founded in the 14th Amendment and our obligation to have equal protection of all human beings under the law. And perhaps this presidential nominee is not going to take a position on that, but we cannot cede that ground ever.
And again, this whole week has brought to the surface the debate over a 15-week limit, a debate over the federal government's role in protecting against abortion. What's your response to pro-lifers who say, well, the goal has always been to overturn Roe so that it would be a state's issue?
Well, there is not one political leader, political organization leader that I know that has ever said, when we finally get the power, it'll only be in the states. There are a lot of people who've been elected to public office who have said that, but that has never been the position of the pro-life movement. The pro-life movement's position has always been that this is about the human dignity, and it's about the 14th Amendment. It's about and that it could never, any human rights movement that's been successful in all of our nation's history has been grounded in the dignity of the individual, and it has never stopped at a state line. Geography should never predict whether you live or die, and all these human rights movements have borne that out over time. We cannot be the movement that makes a state's rights only issue out of a child born in California.
You yourself have said, you know, a 15-week limit doesn't please everyone. You know, even maybe it's 2 weeks for some. Why 15 weeks? And what's your response to that? I've heard some of your pro-abortion critics say that they chose 15 weeks because it polled well.
Well, actually, our critics are correct. It did poll well. Polling means, and poll after poll after poll, reflects a building consensus that the country is somewhere, not nowhere. They're not for unlimited abortion as a nation, and they're not, unfortunately, for life at conception. And they're somewhere between 12 and 15 weeks is the consensus. That's what shows over and over and over again. If it could be our view, and it should be all of our view who love the unborn child and their mothers, that we should be as bold as we can without outstripping consensus. We don't want to pull so far that we can't pull some of those children off the railroad tracks. But what would be morally wrong is to let them all stay on the railroad tracks when the train is coming. And because of our purity or sense of dignity or sense of that's just a little bit weak, pull nobody off. So the idea that somehow we ask for nothing and we build towards nothing because we don't have as much as we want is not what human rights movements have taught us over time, that incrementalism means that you save some. Ask Lincoln what he did. It was the same thing.
In 2016, Trump famously penned a pro-life letter outlining his commitments under your guidance, I believe. And he, at the time, committed to signing a late-term abortion ban into law. Do you see his announcement this week as backing away from that promise if he's reelected?
Kellyanne Conway and I worked on that letter with our team. It was with full knowledge of where we hoped he would go. He absolutely embraced that. The most important part was the judges. He he followed through on all of that. He did what he could, even on the 20-week idea, that limit, and with a statement of administration policy. He said, bring that legislation to my desk, please. So what I think is true, he's always had a keen sense of the political. I think that this is one issue that he is just is wrong. He's landed in the wrong place. But he has decided this is how he's going to handle it politically. I think no matter what, the contrast is still obvious what we have to do. We have to have a pro-life Senate and a pro-life presidency, even if it's not the full-blown that we want. But yes, I think it's obviously a change. It's a change that, but I'm sure that the other side will exploit, and we will just point to the lives that will be saved if we have a president that allows states to move forward.
Marjorie Dannenfelser, thank you for taking the time. And what I know has been a busy week, appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine.
Of course, all of the issues we just discussed will remain top of mind as we head towards this fall's election. Stay with EWTN News for more political coverage important to Catholic voters across all of our print, digital, and broadcast platforms.
I can promise you that after I went in and aborted that child, I didn't want to live anymore.
Next, life on the streets, desperation, crisis, and tragic life choices. How the Holy Spirit turned this woman's life around.
I went in one day with my camera, and there was Padre Pio on the terrace. And he asked me, "What are you doing with that box?" And I replied, "This is a camera that takes photos."
And later, capturing the image of a future saint. We talked to the photographer given rare access to a camera-shy priest as his exclusive photos are released to the public. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. Over the last month, this program has brought you a series of stories on a pastoral approach to homelessness. Now, a concerning report this week from California shows just how massive a battle tackling homelessness can be. California is home to about 30% of all the homeless people in the United States. Though $24 billion have been spent in California the past 5 years to address the problem, the audit uncovered the state does not consistently track whether that public money is actually improving the situation. The report cites a so-called data desert and lack of transparency at every level, from county-led efforts to high-profile programs, as California continues to struggle with growing homelessness numbers. Perhaps one of the best ways to understand homelessness is to have experienced it yourself. Today, we share one woman's long and sad story of life on the streets. Now living in California and helping the battle against homelessness there, Jessica Echeverry credits her husband, well-known Catholic podcaster and public speaker Deacon Charlie Echeverry, with showing her a safe and loving path towards a normal life. Reporter Russell Regis brings us Jessica Echeverry's faith journey in depth, from a life of homelessness towards God.
I'm Jessica Echeverry. I'm married to Deacon Charlie. We've been married for 22 years.
Jessica Echeverry is a devout Catholic, motivational speaker, author, and founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization that helps homeless families called Sofisa. But behind this strong and faithful woman is a heart-wrenching past. Throughout her adolescent life, she was molested, raped, physically and emotionally abused, neglected, and made homeless.
Living on the streets and being in that environment, it's the way I explain it is literally hell. It's all darkness.
Echeverry was living with her grandparents when she found out that she was pregnant at 16 years old. After learning that she was with child, her grandfather told her to leave the house.
16, that's when I got pregnant and had nowhere to go, and ended up living temporarily in a crack and prostitution house. That was one of the most traumatic experiences that I've ever had as a person.
After crying to her mother for help, Echeverry was placed in a maternity home until she gave birth. But unfortunately, she and her newborn son were turned away by her family. And although her son ended up in the care of her then-boyfriend's family, they had no place for her either.
I was homeless on the streets. I spent my first night homeless at age 16, sleeping on the beach in Fort Lauderdale.
While homeless, she was living a lifestyle of extreme poverty, exposed to drug making, sales, use, and abuse. At 18, she hit rock bottom after she had an abortion.
So at 18, when I got pregnant, the voice in my head literally said, "The best thing you can do for this child is to abort it." And I believed it. Yeah, I believed that that was what I was supposed to do.
At 21, she was pregnant with her third child and in an abusive relationship. One day, she ended up in the emergency room, where little did she know at the time, a nurse was going to serve as her redeemer.
I was about 5 months pregnant and was severely abused and was thrown through a plate glass window and ended up in the emergency room. And it was in the emergency room where the triage nurse actually begged me if she could help me. And, you know, long story short, I accepted that help and ended up really for the first time being in under a roof by myself, pregnant, about to have a child.
Echeverry knew this was her chance to make a better life for herself and her baby, the first baby she would be able to bring home. After giving birth to her daughter, she was able to find a job as an office temp. Then, after a couple of years, another blessing came her way. She met her husband, Charlie.
He was that one healthy relationship, especially male relationship, in my life that allowed me to see my own dignity.
Echeverry and her husband built a home together and welcomed two sons.
They eventually moved from Florida to Los Angeles, where Echeverry felt another calling.
When we first moved out to Los Angeles in 1999, we were driving by a park here in Santa Monica, and I saw the homeless. And I just heard in my heart, go back out there.
She at first ignored those calls in fears of reliving those memories of when she was homeless. But she continued to feel that strong tug in her heart.
I went back out there and I sat down and I started having conversations with all of the homeless that were in the park that day.
That was how Safisa started, creating friendships with the homeless. At the same time she was lending a hand to the needy, Echeverry was on the road to healing.
I started reading about, you know, Eastern spirituality and all these things and went on this journey.
While her husband took their three children to Mass, she would go to a self-realization temple where she would meditate near a lake.
There were these huge tapestries, and it was of all their prophets, of all, like, kind of the deities they worshipped, right? And right in the middle of those tapestries was Jesus. I had a mystical experience. He came out of the tapestry like a hologram. He looks at me and he says, "Welcome. I'm glad you're here. I see you've met my friends." And then he said, "But you're searching for me. I'm the one you're looking for."
Echeverry fell to her knees and felt a sense of overwhelming fulfillment. That experience lit a fire in her. She started to join her husband for Mass and was very curious about the Catholic faith. In 2008, she became part of the church. Whatever she learned, she applied to Safisa.
So it was like all of this stuff was making sense now that I was bringing these two worlds together. We run Safisa based on those three very important Catholic social principles and Catholic social teaching, which is the dignity of the human person, the principle of solidarity, and the principle of subsidiarity.
Now, 25 years since its inception, Safisa accompanies more than 90 families in all stages of housing instability. As for her faith journey, Echeverry is at a point in her life where she now prays for the ones who have wounded her.
I hope and pray that when I die and hopefully I see Jesus' face, I see that my love for them was successful and that their lives were reconciled to God because I chose to love them in that way.
Brussels Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
If you would like to learn more about Safisa, you can go to the website at www.safisa.org. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Pomp and circumstance this week at the White House as the President and First Lady hosted a state dinner for Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his wife. This as the United States seeks to strengthen its relationships with one of its strongest allies in the face of many international challenges. Diplomacy and American efforts to build alliances in the critical Indo-Pacific region top the week in review. Beyond the pomp and ceremony, meetings focused on military, economic, and other cooperation between the two longtime allies, part of the administration's plan to counter China's aggressive tactics in the South China Sea. As part of that initiative, President Biden later expanded his meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister into a trilateral summit to include the President of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. The discussions to deepen maritime and security ties are part of an administration's goal to build alliances of like-minded nations, pushing back together against China's trade, technology, and military influence. As the U.S. tries to shore up alliances in the Pacific, the stalemate continues over its role in supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression. Threatened by a conservative faction on his right, House Speaker Mike Johnson has still not called for a vote on a military aid package for Ukraine, despite bipartisan support. In remarks to a joint meeting of Congress on Thursday, even Prime Minister Kishida urged Congress to approve the aid, saying, quote, "The Ukraine of today may be the East Asia of tomorrow, and that allies need to know they can count on America." Earlier in the week, top U.S. military leaders urged Congress to act during a hearing of the House Armed Services Committee.
The severity of this moment cannot be overstated. If we do not continue to support Ukraine, Ukraine could lose. They're really dependent this year on us, Mr. Chairman. And without our support, they will not be able to prevail.
Action towards a ceasefire in Israel also appears stalled. Negotiators are demanding Hamas release 40 Israeli hostages in the first phase of a ceasefire. But Hamas says it is unable to identify and track down 40 Israeli hostages that meet the criteria for release. This has led to fears that more hostages may now be dead than are publicly known. Officially, almost 100 hostages are still believed to be held. Palestinian residents who fled Israel's offensive in Gaza's second-largest city, Khan Yunis, started to return this week after the Israeli military announced an end to its operation there. Many had hoped to move back into their homes, but found instead a city in ruins. Most came on foot from the south or by donkey cart, hoping to at least retrieve belongings. They found that even buildings still partially standing are unlivable.
We came to see what happened to the house, but we didn't find any houses in the first place. It's just rubble. You can't live here. Animals can't live here. So how is a person supposed to? The destruction is unreal.
No words can describe my pain. I have no words to express my feelings. Our memories, our dreams, our childhood, our family are all gone. I didn't find anything to take out from the rubble. We didn't take anything when we fled.
Israel began its ground offensive in Khan Yunis in December in response to the Hamas-led attack on October 7th as it tried to root out Hamas terrorists. The aftermath of war has left the city unrecognizable. The Israeli army says its troops are now regrouping and preparing to enter what they believe to be Hamas's last stronghold, the city of Rafah, which is now sheltering more than half of Gaza's population with nowhere else to go. There is a spark of Catholic hope to report from France. The country saw a record number of adults be baptized during the recent Easter Vigil. The Bishops' Conference of France released its annual survey of catechumens last month. More than 7,000 adults received the sacrament of baptism this year, up from more than 5,000 in 2023. A third of those adults are 25 or under. Adolescents saw a steeper increase, with 5,000 being baptized this year, compared to almost 3,000 last year. Celine Tadier, Europe correspondent for EWTN News and a native of France, says there is no clear answer as to why France, the eldest daughter of the church, is seeing this revival. But she says the trend makes it an outlier among many of its European neighbors.
Very recent statistics provided by the Holy See mentioned the fact that the overall number of baptized Catholics is increasing worldwide. But it's mainly due also to demographics. In Europe, I looked at the numbers. It's quite stable. The situation is rather stable. So in this context, France seems to stand out quite a lot. It's like a unique phenomenon, as well as Belgium. So it's interesting, like France and Belgium have been at the forefront of dechristianization over the past years and decades, and they are now at the forefront of this revival.
France has some of the lowest rates of church attendance in the world. New data from Pew Research paints a picture of Catholics in America, a majority of whom say they do not attend Mass every week. Only 3 in 10 Catholics say they attend Mass weekly, though more than half say they pray on a daily basis. 6 in 10 Catholics say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and around 7 out of 10 Catholics view Pope Francis favorably. For a full report on this new research from Pew, go to our news partners at National Catholic Register and the Catholic News Agency. Difficult court testimony this week during a bankruptcy hearing for the Archdiocese of Baltimore. 6 sexual abuse survivors recounted their experiences as victims of Baltimore clergy members between the mid-1940s and 2002. They are but 6 of several hundred seeking damages from the Archdiocese. Those civil claims were halted when the Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy last year. Baltimore Archbishop William Laurie was in the courtroom on Monday to hear their testimony. After departing the courthouse, the Archdiocese released this statement. I am deeply grateful to the victim survivors for their courage today, and I am moved by their heartrending experience. I offer my sincerest apology on behalf of the Archdiocese for the terrible harm caused to them by representatives of the church. What happened to them never should have occurred. Survivors will address the court again on May 20th. Lori is scheduled to attend. Sun and moon, bless the Lord. On Monday, millions of North Americans paused their daily activities for a rare sight, a total solar eclipse. From Mexico to Maine, onlookers donned special eclipse glasses as the moon completely obscured the sun. It's the first solar eclipse visible from the United States since 2017, and another one like it won't take place until 2045. The astronomical event took on special significance for Catholics, who also celebrated the incarnation of Christ on the Solemnity of the Annunciation Monday. Catholics across the country, from religious sisters to school students, were able to make the eclipse a part of their prayers and meditations. As the moon reflects the light of the sun, so too does Mary reflect the radiance of her son, Jesus.
Well, I've often asked myself that too. Why he got angry with others, even with his brother priests, if they took photos of him, but not with me.
A trusted photographer's firsthand account of how he got these rare pictures of Saint Padre Pio. Next.
Saint Padre Pio, the Capuchin friar famous for his stigmata and mystical experiences, was 81 years old when he died in 1968. Renowned for his holiness and healing powers, thousands from around the world made pilgrimages to Italy to meet him, confess to him, and ask for help. One person who still has a vivid memory of Padre Pio is an 89-year-old photographer. Through the St. Pio Foundation, he is releasing 10 never-before-seen photos of the man who would become a saint. Correspondent Colin Flynn has our report.
These are never-before-seen photographs of the saint, Padre Pio. These rare images of the Italian friar show him celebrating Mass and deep in prayer, as well as lighter moments of laughter, rarely captured of the saint. The images are being released for the 10th anniversary of the St. Pio Foundation and were captured in the town where he spent most of his life, living in a monastery, San Giovanni Rotondo, where crowds would flock to see who they believed even then to be a holy and deeply spiritual man.
The man in those images is known the world over, one of the most revered saints in the Catholic Church. But what about the man behind the camera, the man who has taken some of the most iconic pictures there are of Padre Pio? Well, I've come here to San Giovanni Rotondo to meet him.
Photographer Elia Stiletto lives here in the town where he still has his studio. Today he's 89 and proudly displays in his studio a picture of him when he was around 16 with Padre Pio. And it was around this time that he started photographing the monk who would become the saint.
When was the first time you looked through a camera lens at Padre Pio?
Well, I had bought a very cheap camera, and no one ever entered the monastery to take pictures. It was impossible. But I went in one day with my camera, and there was Padre Pio on the terrace. And he asked me, "What are you doing with that box?" And I replied, "This is a camera that takes photos." He said, "What do you know about it?" And I said, "Let's do something. Pose, and I'll take some photos of you."
Lo metto, lo faccio posare, metto lì e lo provo a fare. Dico, cominciamo a fare le prime fotografie con te.
A young Elia got to work, photographing Padre Pio whenever he could, and sometimes showing the images to him.
Però Padre Pio, io le facevo vedere a lui le fotografie tutti I giorni.
When I would show the pictures to Padre Pio, he would tell me that he didn't like them and that I made him look ugly.
Non era bello, padre, quando...
He never liked the pictures. And remember, when Padre Pio posed, he was always very stern. And I would tell him, "You pose like a policeman." So I said, "This is your fault, not mine."
E la colpa è la tua, non è la mia.
Padre Pio never wanted flash to be used in the church. And when Elia would develop the film from his camera, he started to notice something very strange.
Queste foto sono tutte foto misteriose.
In other photographs, there's something very mysterious going on. You see, the convent was dark, and Padre Pio never wanted me to use the flash. And he would celebrate Mass with just two candles. So it was very dark. I always thought the pictures would never come out. And in other pictures, there is a light behind him. He's against the light. He should have appeared black. But in all these pictures, he appears clear, fully lit. These are very mysterious pictures. But in all of them, Padre Pio's face is fully lit. It's amazing.
Today, Elia still works in his studio, archiving the many pictures he took of St. Padre Pio and meeting people who come to visit from around the world. We're sitting here in your studio, surrounded by these incredible images of Padre Pio. Why do you think Padre Pio chose you to be his photographer, even though it wasn't a formal official arrangement? But what did he see in you?
Well, I've often asked myself that too. Why he got angry with others, even with his brother priests, if they took photos of him, but not with me. Perhaps he saw something in me from when I was a child. I had an extraordinary attraction to Padre Pio. I spent a lot of time with him, and inside I felt this sensation of wanting to always take new and more beautiful photos of him. I really do feel lucky, and I still don't fully understand why Padre Pio gave me this gift. Being close to him was like being in paradise. Even now, it feels like I spend all day with Padre Pio. It doesn't seem to me that he's dead. To me, he seems alive. I am making this gift because I would like these photos to help others. I do it gladly, with all my heart. I really hope they can benefit everyone. To bring happiness to those in difficulty.
So next time you're looking at a picture of St. Padre Pio, spare a thought for the man who likely took it. In San Giovanni Rotondo, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
What stunning images. St. Padre Pio, pray for us. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We look forward to seeing you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.